On this episode of China Unscripted, China sends a lunar probe to the moon. Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping meet in China. More shady dealings with Huawei. And we speak to Ian Easton from the Project 2049 Research Institute about a speech Xi Jinping gave about the future of Taiwan. Hi, welcome to the China Unscripted podcast. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
And I just want to remind all of you to subscribe to us on iTunes and give us 4 stars. Or is it 5 stars?
Five.
Give us 5 stars. Forget the 4 stars. 5 stars. Give us 5 stars. And leave a good review.
We actually have a lot of good 5-star ratings, but only 3 reviews.
Oh, well. So there's room for improvement in our fans.
There's room for more reviews.
Give us some reviews. And 5 stars. 6 stars would be best. Anywho, hey, how was your holidays, you guys? Have a good New Year's, a happy holidays, a Merry Christmas.
All of the above.
Wow, thanks for the detail, Shelley.
I mean, you know.
Well, anyways, as I'm sure all of you listening are so thrilled to hear, I have a beard. I know it makes me sound totally different, it's great.
I'm not like thrilled with the beard.
Oh really? I couldn't quite hear what you said, Shelley. Or were you banging your elbows on the table?
Okay, You
said you were thrilled.
Yeah, I think she's thrilled with the beard. You know, a lot of our fans were wondering how, Chris, you were able to grow a magnificent beard in just 2 days between Wednesday and Friday's episodes of China Uncensored.
Oh, I have an absurd amount of testosterone.
Ugh. Okay. Well, since this isn't like the testosterone podcast, let's go back to...
I mean, if it were, we couldn't have you on, Shelley. Am I right, Matt? High five.
Yeah, I don't want to be on this podcast. See you guys later.
Oh, God, Matt, it's just you and me.
No, Shelley, come back.
Yeah, you know, guys, I really missed you during our Christmas break.
Yeah, well, okay, Shelley, I'm a modern sensitive man. I can understand that this sort of boyish humor is not, it's beneath you. So let's get a little serious. Next topic, first topic, China is the first country to land a lunar probe on the moon. Is Uranus next?
Excuse me?
Did I stutter?
We are not talking about Uranus, Chris.
Okay, China might have future plans for Uranus. Currently, it was a lunar probe to the moon. We'll talk about the moon, Shelley. You're right. We shouldn't jump the gun. China, the first country to land a lunar probe on the moon.
It's
the dark side.
The dark side of the moon.
Yes. I believe that there have been...
No. The U.S. was faked.
Oh, God.
And by the way, let me tell you about the reptilians.
Oh, boy, this is going to go well.
Well, we had a good run, guys. We had, like, 18 episodes.
Why, is the deep state shutting us down, Shelley?
Oh, gosh.
Anywho, you know, the thing that I have a question about, when China landed this lunar probe, I saw a lot of people say the far side of the moon. I'm used to hearing the dark side of the moon.
Well, it is, from a technical level, the far side of the moon, because one side of the moon always faces away from us, mm-hmm. and therefore is dark to us, but it's... You know, when it's full moon for us, it's dark on the far side of the moon. When it's a new moon for us, then it's bright on the dark side of the moon.
It's actually called the dark side for being unknown and not being dark, according to Wikipedia.
Oh,
thank you, Accuracy Ninja.
You know, I don't know if Wikipedia is right because they're not right about everything.
So many things.
But that was what my 5-second Googling got us.
Yeah. But at any rate, but the technical challenge with it is that in order to land something, you need to have radio communications with it. And so China first had to launch a craft that would orbit the moon so that during the landing process of the probe, it could communicate through this relay orbiting satellite of the moon back to Earth.
Which was actually pretty cool. It would be cooler if, you know, China's space program wasn't run by their military and...
You know. Details.
Details.
Yeah. But yeah, it was impressive, and it actually...
I mean, as moon landings go, as unmanned moon landings go, it's the most impressive so far. Obviously not the most impressive among all moon landings, because America is number one.
Well, I mean, I guess putting people on adds like another level of...
Americans have golfed on the moon. Hmm.
Especially when you consider that the technology used in the Apollo space missions was like, the amount of technology on that spacecraft is like fewer megabytes than would fit on our iPhones, you know?
Really?
It's like, it was so incredibly low tech compared to what we have now. It's almost amazing that like anyone made it back alive.
Wow.
Or even got up there in the first place.
Yeah, actually. It almost sounds like the whole thing was faked in a studio by Stanley Kubrick in Vegas, Roswell.
Oh, Matt, we just walked into that one. We just stumbled into that blindly. Oh, God.
Yeah. It's good to be here with you guys.
Oh, yeah. Whoa, happy 2019.
A whole new year of this. But obviously, the lunar probe is the first step in the ultimate goal of getting a base on the moon, which China wants to put a manned base on the far side of the moon, which technically is kind of the Chinese military building a base on the moon, which technically shouldn't be legal, according to international space treaties.
The moon has been part of China's territory since Chang'e times.
Oh, this
that's,
is
that's
true.
True. She's got. There's already like a temple there, right? Like a
temple on the moon. And Matt, who's the conspiracist now?
And a jade rabbit.
Oh yeah.
Don't forget about the rabbit. Actually, you can see the rabbit in the moon.
Shelley, what's the story of Chang'e for our audience who is not aware?
Oh well, okay. Which version of the story? I guess
the historically accurate one.
Okay,
please.
The historically accurate one. There was once seven suns in the sky. And it gets more historically accurate for that. The idea is that there is a Chinese woman on the moon because she drank the elixir of immortality, possibly out of selfishness or possibly to save the world, depending on the version of the story. And then because you can't be on Earth anymore once you are an immortal, she flew to the moon, and there she lives by herself, also with a jade rabbit who makes the elixir of immortality. Mm.
Which is how we got the song Fly Me to the Moon.
Oh, yes. Interesting. I did not know that Frank Sinatra was a Chang'e fan.
Oh yeah. Mm. Big Chang'e fan.
We have
a
question about this jade rabbit, because you can look at the moon and see the rabbit, right?
Yes.
So the rabbit is like the size of the moon, right?
I mean, it's smaller than the man in the moon.
What's the difference between fairy tales and conspiracies? I'm getting mixed up now.
Well, conspiracy theories are fairy tales, but without fairies.
All right, we'll accept that.
Okay.
Oh, hey, you know what was cool this year, starting off this year, is when Time Out Shanghai listed this as one of the best China podcasts, specifically for news and information, and I have to agree. I think we have high-quality content.
Especially when we're talking about how big the jade rabbit on the moon is.
Is that a euphemism?
What? How is that a euphemism?
I don't know. You're the one with the dirty mind.
No. No, it is not a euphemism. Also, yes, we were one of the best 18 podcasts about China.
Well, one of the best six on the news and current events.
You know
category.
What, actually?
Number two on that list.
Look,
they weren't numbered.
They were listed alphabetically, yeah. Chris.
So we were number two.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, actually, what really made me laugh about that list is that also in our category was a podcast by China CRI, which is China Radio International, which is the Chinese state-run radio media that has been secretly buying up TV, radio stations in the U.S. and broadcasting.
Yep. Them and us, side by side.
I feel like we should do a collaboration with them.
I agree. Where, we should get them on the show.
If you're state-run media, like, you're not allowed to joke around off the cuff, right? Mm. Because it's too politically dangerous. So we could do a joint podcast with them where we just continuously make jokes as they become increasingly less and less comfortable.
I feel like we might be handing them some compromise, though. Like, they will just then broadcast this as, this is how stupid, you know,
Western media is. They'd be wrong because we are broadcasting this ourselves. Man, I'm on fire today. Okay. Yes. Enough joking around. So, lunar probe to the moon. This is obviously going to kickstart China's future plans. So, when will they go to Uranus?
Next topic.
Speaking of Uranus, Xi Jinping met with Kim Jong-un.
What?
We're not going to lead in like that.
What?
Because they're both fat, so you think... They have problems with their anuses, I imagine.
No, that doesn't even logically fall. No, Chris.
I do not want to think about the bathroom habits.
You know, when Kim Jong-un travels, he has a private bathroom that he carries with him, so his feces can be collected by his people.
I think when we actually talked about that in an episode, people were like, that happens with U.S. officials, too.
Yeah, well, that still means he does it. Like, okay. What I said is still factually facts.
It is still factually facts. Now I do not want to think about, and I am thinking about, all of the world leaders traveling around and having their poop collected by an underling.
I wonder what they do with it. And I wonder how you get that job. Oh, and I wonder how much it pays. And if it pays more than this.
It's why it's called the Secret Service.
Oh, please tell me we're going to cut this.
The number two intelligence agency.
So,
Time Out Shanghai, top 18 China podcasts.
Okay.
What a world. So, yes, Kim Jong-un has met with Xi Jinping in China yet again.
I think it's the fourth time.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you're going to have a birthday party.
You're going to get in your armored train, mm-hmm. and you're going to travel 40 hours across the board into Beijing, party city.
That's what I would
do. I mean, I'd still rather have a birthday in China than in North Korea.
Well, when you're Kim Jong-un, I'm pretty sure you can still get pretty much anything you'd need.
Yes. I'm imagining so.
I wonder what his armored train car looks like on the inside.
Supposedly very luxurious. I wonder if Dennis Rodman has seen it.
Is it luxurious like... Because there's different standards of luxury. There's like the North Korea Pyongyang 5-star hotel luxurious, which is like a 2.5-star hotel in America, like a Super 8.
Well, Kim Jong-un went to like boarding school in Switzerland.
That's true. There's like Swiss luxury, or there's like Dubai luxury.
I think it's probably on a scale of Switzerland to Dubai.
On a scale of North Korea to Dubai. Let's use that scale.
Wait, what is North Korea? North Korea is the 2.5-star.
Well, let's do a 7-star scale.
Okay.
So North Korea is 1, uh-huh. and Dubai is 7.
Okay.
Okay. So what do you think Kim Jong-un's train?
Hold on.
Is
what would Switzerland be?
Like a 5.
Okay. So what would a 6 be?
Sultan of Brunei.
Yeah.
Okay. Boom. Wow. You were just on that. So, back to the premise. We need to reestablish the premise. On that scale, what is the luxury of Kim Jong-un's armored car? I'm going to say a 6.
I'm going to say it's probably no more than 4.5.
Really?
I'm going to say 5 because Kim Jong-un has never experienced Dubai, so he doesn't know what he's missing, but he would want the best of what he's ever had.
Very good point.
But I feel like it's a lot to put into a train car. Like, North Korea has to sell a lot of meth to afford that train car.
I don't know where you come up with this slander about the True Korea, Matt. Have you ever been to North Korea?
I have, actually, with you.
Oh, yeah, actually. We were in North Korea.
For, like, at least 5 minutes, we were standing across the line at the Joint Security Area.
It was exactly like The Interview.
So how many stars was that on the North Korea to Dubai scale?
Oh, that was about a 3. Still better than staying in a hotel in Pyongyang, but only marginally.
I see.
But, yeah, no, I was, because when I watched The Interview, I definitely thought about, like, you and me, Chris.
Yeah,
like,
we have the Franco, what's his face? The other guy?
Franco, what's his face? I'm guessing you think you're Franco.
I'm Franco,
for sure. I'm definitely what's his face.
Seth Rogen?
Yeah. Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen.
Although, Seth Rogen's the one with the beard, so.
That's true. Maybe I'm both.
Not going to give up being the star. I see how it is.
Geez. So for actual information, Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping. So this is the significance of this is that, it's expected in about a month or two, Trump and Kim are going to meet again. And so, you know, a lot of experts are kind of saying that this is a way for, like, China to show that it's still in the game. It still has connections with North Korea. And so it's like the U.S. has to bargain. It's not the only game in town.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely that there was no real relation between Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un prior to the U.S. and North Korea starting to move towards, like, having talks, and then...
So what you're saying is Trump is bringing people together.
Do we want these people to be together, though? like, you know, really?
No, probably not.
I just, like, also...
Actually, I do, because it's kind of like I loved the episodes of the Super Friends that had to deal with the Legion of Doom. So, like, individual bad guys are, like, you know, cool, but when there's, like, a secret society of bad guys working together, well, those were the two-part episodes.
Okay, you lost me with that reference.
No, so what you're saying is you like it because it allows us to do two-part episodes on China Uncensored.
Have we ever done that? I don't think we have.
we remember we did that one about A Brief History of Communism, which was part one.
That's right.
Well, we're so brief, we covered it all.
That's true. Hey, we'll have more on our history, our series on the history of communism coming up in 2019.
I'm really going to suggest that we don't promise that.
I think the 2019 is the year that we will make our 2017 promise come true.
That's the New Year's resolution.
That's the New Year's resolution. Maybe it'll be on American Covered. That might fit nicely there.
So... I just lost my train of thought. But oh.
Was it a luxury armored car?
It was a luxury armored train, definitely, because I've been on so many of those. Actually, what I was going to say is that one thing that was significant coming out of the Kim Jong-un Xi Jinping trip was that the North Korea has formally invited Xi Jinping to come to North Korea, and Xi Jinping has apparently accepted.
Oh, has that's never happened, right?
Xi Jinping has never been to North Korea, no.
And so the whole reason for this is the Kim family was supported heavily by Jiang Zemin, the former leader of China.
And people like Zhou Yongkang.
Who are part of his little clique. And that's like the political faction inside of the Chinese Communist Party that Xi Jinping kind of hates. So that might be why there was such a disconnect between him and Kim Jong-un. Why Kim never went to China or never spoke to Xi Jinping until suddenly... Trump came onto the scene and had a summit with him.
Right, but to be fair, Jiang Zemin's relationship with North Korea was mainly with Kim Jong-il, which is the Kim Jong-un's deceased father.
Yeah.
So, you know...
Well, but Zhou Yongkang, one of his guys, was there when Kim Jong-un was inaugurated. Is that the right word for what happened with him?
It must have been elected, right? I mean, we can only assume.
Descended from heaven to grace the earth.
Out of a seashell. arose from the foaming waters.
Oh, no. Now I'm thinking of the Venus design or whatever it's called, but with Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, you know.
I have an idea for the thumbnail of this episode.
Oh, geez. I don't know if I have the skill or the stomach to make that.
Just lots of hair. Mm-hmm. Lots of hair.
Lots of hair.
So much hair. Okay. That's beautiful. That's really pretty much all we could possibly want to say about that.
I think so.
I feel like we have so much dead air on this podcast when we just it becomes so awkward. There's nothing to say.
Well, we have a couple more topics to discuss, and one of them is one of our favorite Chinese telecom companies, Huawei.
I feel like 2019 is not going to be a good year for Huawei.
Not gonna call you on my Huawei telephone. That was like a Lady Gaga song, right? The telephone. She had a song called Telephone. I hope she wasn't talking about Huawei because it would be a national security concern.
I'm going to say she was not talking about Huawei.
She must have been talking about ZTE, the other Chinese telecom company.
ZTE, you mean?
Oh. I spent too much time in Australia and New Zealand last year. Actually, probably not enough time.
Actually, we could go back, guys. We could go back and spend even longer in Australia and New Zealand in 2019.
Why?
Well, yeah.
That's... You think we're done?
I mean, I ate a possum. What else is there to do?
Yeah, you know, I think we went and we solved their China infiltration problem.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's fine now.
Well, New Zealand and Australia are, you know, coming out surprisingly strong in terms of standing up to, you know, Huawei, at least when it comes to building the 5G network.
The national 5G network. There was the Australian state government that signed a contract with Huawei last year.
Was, I think, specifically to build the 4G network on, like, public transit.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like...
Don't worry, there was also a recent article in the Washington Post about how maybe metro cars built in China could spy on people.
Or be programmed to crash.
In one of those states. Yeah.
But hey, you know, we don't want Huawei to build the 5G networks, but who's going to build the OG network? Ice Cube. Shelley, you're really clenching your jaw a lot.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh.
What I liked Ice Cube growing up.
Actually, I'm not sure I've ever heard an Ice Cube song, now that I think about it.
They're not songs, they're raps, Shelley.
Okay, one of his famous ones is like, "It's a good day."
Okay.
It was a good day.
And then, okay, right.
Right. He talks about all the things that happened on that day and how great it was.
I do remember that because somebody on the internet calculated what day it was from all the references. Uh-huh.
Because, of course, came up
with a specific date and year. Yeah.
Fortunately, those were the days before Huawei.
At least
in the U.S. But yeah, it seems like, you know, in December there was the arrest of the Huawei CFO, Meng Wanzhou, in Canada at the U.S. request. And since then, Huawei has become a huge topic. You know, China, in response, abducted at least two Canadian citizens in retaliation for that. And yeah, it seems like it's now sort of like setting the stage for 2019, where this is a year where lots of countries are going to try and build 5G networks.
Yes, 5G is the new thing.
And should I talk about some crazy conspiracies about 5G?
No.
Okay.
Let's not do that.
All right.
Well. And so potential health concerns aside, there's the security issue,
which goes back to Huawei. And countries around the world are deciding about, do we want to have Huawei build these critical infrastructures?
So I guess we should say that Huawei has kind of two business things. One is like the phones, the mobile phones, and like that kind of like personal, like those types of like consumer products. But they also build telecommunications cables, like the actual hardware that lots of, you know, you have to use to actually build not just 5G networks, but, you know, all sorts of like like internet stuff. Underwater internet cables in the South Pacific.
Shelley, fish don't need internet.
No, fish don't, but
the porpoises do. Porpoise?
Are you doing this on porpoise?
Porpoise. No. Okay.
Talking about Shanghai, top China podcast.
Okay. So
so we have a better idea now, thank you, Shelley, of what Huawei does. And since Huawei has some very shady connections to the Chinese Communist Party, for many years, countries, especially the United States, have been concerned about the security risk it poses.
I think what's interesting is if you kind of read up about the basic case that led to the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, mm-hmm. actually started in the U.S. back in 2010. Mm. So this has been, they've been investigating this for a while. Like, there was basically like prosecutors from different areas where Huawei had companies in the U.S. started looking into, and the FBI started looking into Huawei and their leadership and their business practices, and they started to become concerned that the Huawei was directly working for the Chinese Communist Party, that Huawei's business leaders were doing things directly related to the Chinese Communist Party. But it is very, very difficult to prosecute on like that kind of espionage. So they decided to go after them for bank fraud.
Yeah. And like the mafia.
Yeah, basically what happened with Al Capone, the tax evasion thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to go after Huawei for basically tricking banks into violating U.S. sanctions with Iran by the fact that Huawei was secretly doing business in Iran and selling U.S. technology to Iran through shell companies. That they were like, no, these are independent companies. We're not doing any of this. And meanwhile, processing those financial transactions through Huawei. And so when, you know, like HSBC or another bank processes Huawei's financial transactions, they're accidentally doing business with Iran too.
Okay, here's the thing. Not to lessen the crimes committed by Huawei in this regard, but like, do you really think that these big international banks with all their anti-fraud departments and all that, they're like, oh, we had no idea this was related
actually,
to Iran.
Actually, according to the reporting so far, HSBC itself was quite concerned because they had previously gotten in trouble back in like 2009 or so for violating U.S. sanctions against Iran. So they wanted to be very careful, and they had to pay like
a Uranus load of money.
Yes, yes. Okay. A Uranus load of money to... Like, you can't see, but Chris is snickering.
Chris is so happy about his joke. It's like being 8 years old again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's like the smuggest look I have seen. Anyway, so the point is HSBC actually was not apparently interested in getting caught violating U.S. sanctions again. So,
oh, I'm not saying they're interested in getting caught. But no one who commits fraud is interested in getting caught.
Yeah, no, but if you've already had to pay, I think it was maybe over $1 billion in fines for that, you might want to not do that again.
And look, Matt, I do not like what you're insinuating. There is no room for conspiracies on this show.
You're right. I mean, and honestly, I think there's probably hardly any conspiracies that have to do with the banking industry.
Oh my gosh,
I can't think of any.
Let's take a lunar probe to the moon.
Okay, so Huawei, mm-hmm. Which makes industrial scale spy devices and personal consumer spy devices.
Mm-hmm. And since the arrest, more and more has been coming out. There was a Reuters exclusive that just showed more evidence of these shell companies in Iran, and was it Syria?
It was Syria.
Are you serious?
Why? Like, for like 10 seconds we could talk about something and then immediately derailed by a luxury armored train car. It was Syria and Iran. And basically there was a paper trail that Reuters found in Iran and Syria that showed that there were Huawei officials who were like also listed as the like officials of this, these two shell companies that had nothing to do with Huawei. Yeah.
And then just recently, Poland arrested a Huawei. Was it an executive?
It was a Huawei. Yeah, some Huawei official and also a Polish citizen. So two people were arrested for spying in Poland. But I don't know that there's a lot of detail on that yet.
Shelley, you know the best way to spy on a Polish submarine?
Please don't let this be a terrible ethnic slur.
You just look through the screen door. That's an old joke updated for the 21st century. You're welcome.
Okay.
But at any rate, one of the guys who was arrested, Huawei is kind of like denying that he had anything to do with Huawei. But he was a guy who was a Chinese citizen in Poland who is responsible for sales to public sector clients for Huawei.
So that has nothing to do with Huawei?
Right. Clearly.
Okay.
That's what Huawei is claiming, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, actually, he currently has nothing to do with Huawei since he's now been fired.
That's true. But yeah, it is interesting to see how countries around the world are reacting to this. Like, the United States has been warning about Huawei for a long time. You know, Australia has followed suit. Back in August, they banned Huawei from building the national 5G network.
To be fair, It was a ban on any company that might be unduly influenced or something by a foreign regime.
Yeah. They didn't specifically say Huawei until the Australian official came out and said, oh, yeah, we're talking about Huawei.
I mean, it's like a subtweet. Like, people know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, Matt, it's great that New Zealand, which is being so heavily influenced by the Chinese Communist Party, has also followed suit about, putting restrictions on Huawei's growth. But then, like, oddly enough, you have countries
it's not because they need to put restrictions on Huawei's growth, to be fair. It's just the security issues that come with 5G.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then you have countries like Germany, where it's like, we haven't found any evidence that this is a security concern.
Maybe Germany hasn't. The U.S. seems a little bit worried. But
yeah.
Well, I mean, actually, it was interesting that when this whole case came out, that they had been investigating Huawei for almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you see a few years later, like, U.S. lawmakers coming out and warning about Huawei and, you know, it starting to get, and I think, was it 2013 that they said that Huawei could not compete for, like, a government
contracts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely not, it's, I feel like in this case, it hasn't really struck the U.S. by surprise, basically.
And I'm sure this is probably not going to be the last we hear about shady dealings of Huawei.
No, actually, I think the rumors are that there's a lot more going on that just hasn't come out yet.
Hmm. Ooh, I can't wait.
Yeah.
Something to look forward to in 2019. Okay, the other thing I want to talk about today is, you know, what I love about the Chinese Communist Party is how it tries to sneak breaking news events in around Christmas time when they assume the rest of the world will be too busy with caroling or something to notice. So, you know, this January, Xi Jinping, this was the big story. Xi Jinping gave a speech about what a wonderful future awaits Taiwan when it submits to Beijing rule. Also, independence would be disastrous. I'm sure you can imagine how disastrous it would be to be independent from China.
Yeah, it looked super disastrous when we were there.
Watching a thriving democracy?
Yes.
I almost combined thriving and vibrant. Thribrant. Taiwan has a thribrant democracy. And so, if you'd like to hear better analysis about Taiwan than that, joining us right now is Ian Easton of the Project 2049 Research Institute. Say hi, Ian.
Hi, Ian.
Oh, that's from The Simpsons?
It's from...
I think it is.
It's from, like, being a kid, right?
Well, it's from everything. Like, say goodnight, Gracie. Goodnight, Gracie. Like, oh, it's really old. Yeah.
Okay. You've dated yourself, Ian. That's okay. So, Ian, what is your take on Xi Jinping's speech?
So, if I can be very honest with you guys, would like to roll out some cutting-edge research that I've developed. Over the past 2 weeks, I've been working on a theory. Mm-hmm. And because the first theory is not fully flushed out yet, I've developed a second theory about this very issue, and I'd like to run it by you guys. Would that be okay? I'd love to get your feedback.
I don't know. How does that sound, audience? Oh, we can't communicate with you. yes, that sounds amazing.
Okay, so I have two theories. Theory number one is this. I think that it's possible that Xi Jinping and Wang Qishan had a bet. It could have been over a drinking game. It could have been over a really, really boring banquet in Zhongnanhai. Mm-hmm. I don't know when they made the bet, but I think they probably made a bet.
Okay.
And if Wang Qishan lost, then he would have to call the Dalai Lama and say, Dalai Lama, you know, His Holiness, I love you, and I'm so sorry what I've been doing to you and all of your followers in Tibet and northern India. And if Xi Jinping lost, then he would have to get on TV and threaten Taiwan and rattle his saber and sound all crazy. And so I think Xi Jinping just lost a bet, so he had to do that.
You know,
kind of embarrass himself.
That feels right. That feels right. But just for the sake of it, what's theory two?
Yeah, because it does. To me, it feels, you know, just gut instinct. It feels right, but I don't have the evidence to back it up. So
yeah. Well, I mean, we don't. We're in a post-evidence time in our civilization. It's just go by your gut. Go by your heart.
Yeah, we're just running. We're just running on just gut instinct.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's my gut instinct theory.
Gut instinct and by Joe.
Theory number two is probably backed up with a little more evidence. Although it's still very, very hard, if not impossible, to prove. So theory number two is that Xi Jinping, even though he's the guy that, you know, at the holidays, what gift do you give the guy who has it all, right? He's a dictator. Mm-hmm. He has totally unchecked power over 1.3 plus billion people. He has nuclear weapons at his disposal. I mean, he's got it all. He's got a second aircraft carrier now and more on the way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you would think he has it all. You know, his wife is a movie star and also a general, which is kind of cool. I mean, you know, how many guys can say that, right? But I think deep down, he also wants to have what Tsai Ing-wen has, what President Tsai has. I think he's a little jealous, to be honest.
What does she have?
He's a little envious. Well, she has a lot of things that he doesn't have when you think about it. And it makes sense that he'd be jealous of her because she's the only other leader of a country with China in its name, right? Because there's two Chinas, People's uh-huh. Republic of China and the Republic of China. And so I'm sure when he is looking for a benchmark, when he's looking for a point of comparison, he's looking at her, right? She is his big competition. And she's kind of got it all. You know, I mean, Taiwan's economy has been growing at a fairly fast clip. They had a good year in 2018. Unemployment is very low. I'm sure he'd love to be able to do that in China. Taiwan has a very, very low crime rate. As you guys know, you were just there in December. It's very, very peaceful. It's got a very stable society. Great education system, great public health care system, loyal military. All the things that I'm sure Xi Jinping would love to be able to deliver to the People's Republic of China, but all these are the things that he's not been able to deliver. I mean, he's failing across the board. If he wasn't failing, he wouldn't have to construct concentration camps in Western China. He wouldn't have to purge. He's purged something like 100 general officers in his military have either been executed or imprisoned, and many of them, are, of course, tortured along the way. Many of his political rivals in the CCP have been purged. I mean, these are not the attributes of a leader who's confident and feeling good about where he stands. Tsai Ing-wen was also elected president. You know, Xi Jinping was never elected.
Well, technically, and he was elected unanimously.
Well, no. One person.
One person voted against him.
Yeah. That person's
not. Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of the vote taken of the
National People's Congress.
Yeah.
Well, so Ian, let me see if I get this straight. You're saying Xi Jinping wants to be the first female president of China.
Oh man. This is getting to some deep psychology stuff.
I think he wants to outdo the first female president of China. And he's just not measuring up, to be fair. He's just not doing that good of a job.
So to outdo them,
I think
them,
it probably bugs him.
So to outdo them, he has to talk about taking them over?
It's kind of like, if you can't beat them, force them to join you.
Exactly.
Peacefully.
Yeah, no, I think it's just being grumpy. You know, he's being grumpy.
He's grumpy, in a bad mood, old bear.
And he's lashing out.
Do you think Xi Jinping talking about Taiwan has anything to do with pressure he may be facing inside the party over the trade war?
I think that could certainly be part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, China's economy is really not doing that well. It's one of many, many problems that China faces right now, and one of the many problems that have gotten worse under Xi Jinping's rule. I mean, you know, who would have thought 5 years ago or 6 years ago that people would miss Hu Jintao? I mean, Hu Jintao was not exactly charismatic.
He was
popular,
the life of the party.
But compared to Xi Jinping, he was, you know, he was a genius. He was a brilliant political leader. And so I think, you know, Xi Jinping must be under pressure because the economy is not doing well. Obviously, Chinese society is not particularly stable. If it was, they wouldn't be destroying all the temples and churches and synagogues and mosques across China.
No, I mean, that's just making it more stable.
It's called sinicizing.
Right.
Well, I mean, if there's less buildings, that's less buildings to collapse. So it's more stable.
Exactly.
Right.
That's the kind of deep analysis you can only get on China Unscripted. Thank you, Tom at Shanghai, for ranking us one of the best China podcasts. Okay.
So I wanted to ask you guys,
yeah,
because you guys track this stuff really, really closely, and you have a really good grip on so many different elements of Chinese politics, Chinese culture, Chinese society, Chinese economy. What do you think about my two theories? Do you think it's probably more likely to be theory number one or theory number two, or do you think there's a third possibility?
I'm leaning heavily to first female president myself.
Is that the third possibility?
I think maybe he was trying to trick Tsai Ing-wen into accidentally declaring independence.
That's an interesting idea. And so, you know, this was one of the things I wanted to ask you in response. You know, essentially, Xi Jinping talking about unifying with China or using force if necessary, that's really nothing new. But in response, Tsai actually did become, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first Taiwanese president to actually reject the 1992 consensus where they kind of agreed, where China and Taiwan agreed that there was only one China. So that kind of gives some merit to what Matt said, which I hate to say.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that having a president of Taiwan that's actually willing to stand up to the leader of the Chinese Communist Party is a big deal. Having a leader of any country that's willing to stand up to that kind of pressure and those kind of threats, it's actually pretty impressive. I mean, you know, when was the last time our president, you know, not just the current administration, but past administrations or any elected politician or official of any of our allies, you know, openly stood up and said to the leader of the People's Republic of China, listen, your policies are garbage. This is a joke. You must be kidding me. This doesn't make any sense at all. This is Orwellian garbage. I mean, you don't hear that very often. Well, and our president Tsai did that in a very...
Trump did call it Orwellian garbage.
Orwellian nonsense.
And, yeah, a White House statement about the whole, like, Taiwan, like, changing the airline website thing.
But I think to answer your rhetorical question, literally, the last time a U.S. administration stood up for Taiwan against the CCP was probably in the war over the island of Jinmen, which the last real battles for that were in kind of like the 60s.
It was the 50s. But I mean, also the U.S. has constantly been, you know, sailing warships in the Taiwan Strait, making sure they're selling weapons to Taiwan. So that's pretty big support all along.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think the U.S. has been far from toothless when it comes to Taiwan. And I think probably that could actually be, you know, in addition to the trade war and China's own economic woes and its own social stability woes, it could also be the case that Xi Jinping is under pressure because he anticipates that in the year ahead, in 2019, the United States government is going to be doing much, much more than it has in the past to shore up Taiwan's position politically and in the military and security realm. It could be that he anticipates that, and so he's trying to shape it in advance.
What are some of the things the U.S. could do?
Oh, there's so much we could do. I mean, there's a tremendous, there's a lot of room for improvement. And you can't say that with too many other relationships. I mean, you can't really say that with our alliance with Japan, for example. We can work it on the margins. Same with South Korea or Australia or others. But when it comes to Taiwan, there's huge room for improvement. So just as an example, one thing we could do would be to put Marines at the new American Institute in Taiwan, or the new AIT complex.
Was the American embassy?
The $255 million embassy, quote unquote.
Yeah, the embassy that we don't call an embassy. And, you know, I mean, that could happen in 2019. You never know. You could have really high-quality arms sales, the likes of which we've not seen for some time. We could be selling Taiwan new fighter jets, for example.
No more F-16s.
It could be F-16s. It could be something else. I'm not sure. But I do think that we're likely to see things along those lines. And many other things, high-level visits, you know, general officers and admirals actually going to Taiwan. Some of this stuff may happen in a low-key way, but I think it is going to happen. And I probably Xi Jinping has an inkling of some of the things that are coming, and it probably is putting pressure on him. And so he wants to shape the situation as best as he can, to the degree that he can. And of course, he has only limited ability to do that. But, you know, that could be one of the drivers here.
Hmm. Well, I know Xi was really pushing the idea of the one country, two systems model that's really done so well in Hong Kong. Do you think there's ever any chance that Taiwan would accept that?
I do. I think if the choice was, you know, that or nuclear attack, I think they would probably choose that. But otherwise,
okay.
Otherwise, I think no, it's impossible. You know, the only way that Taiwan is ever going to accept something like that is if its government and its, you know, its people have completely lost all hope for the future. You know, if that's been crushed through, you know, through subversion and espionage and infiltration and, you know, and the U.S. selling Taiwan out and other countries completely ignoring Taiwan. You know, it would take, it would be a very dystopian world at that point for that to ever occur. And so I think the likelihood is very, very close to zero that Taiwan will ever accept anything like the really, really bad, you know, I don't want to sound like, you know, like a politician, but a really bad deal. Hong Kong got a terrible deal. Hmm. And, you know, over the past 5 years, everybody in Taiwan has been watching that very closely. And, you know, and they can see how stupid it was, or how stupid it would be for them to fall for Beijing's lies on one country, two systems. Because it's not two systems. It's one country, full stop.
Well said. Like a nice political speech. Well, so building off of that, the recent elections in Taiwan didn't really go well for Tsai's political party and saw big wins for the KMT, which has been more willing to deal with China. Do you think that is the start of some kind of shift in Taiwanese society that would lead to your wonderful dystopian future?
No, not at all. I think the recent election, while it may have not been a great success for the DPP, it was a great success for Taiwan's democracy on multiple levels. I mean, on one level, because it shows how quickly the people in Taiwan can change their views and they can cycle through. And we've seen this before. You know, we've seen the KMT go to the DPP, back to the KMT, back to the DPP. In 2016, they elected actually a pretty significant number of independent candidates. I mean, at that time, the mayor of Tainan, the mayor of Taipei, and the vice president were all independent candidates. And two of those three are still independent. They're not aligned with any political party. And so that's one of the impressive things about Taiwan's democracy, is it's so vibrant that you can see people changing their opinions. And most people are independent themselves. They're not tied to any specific political party. The other reason I think the election was, you know, despite clear Chinese political interference, I think it was a success because it was peaceful. It was absolutely peaceful. There's no political violence at all. People were not voting in a state of, you know, of intimidation or coercion. And after the elections were over, the U.S. State Department immediately came out in a very full-throated way and actually praised Taiwan's democracy. So that really gave Taiwan's leadership a lot of face. And I think that was very good, too. And so I don't think that, you know, it was a lot of people look at that and they just see the Chinese interference piece and they think, oh, it's a disaster. Taiwan's democracy is so fragile now. I don't think that's the case at all. And I certainly don't believe that people voted based upon their position on cross-strait relations. People in Taiwan almost never vote on that basis. So I don't think we should read into it and think because they voted for the KMT, that means they want, you know, eventual unification. I don't think that's the case at all.
Wow, that was a very beautiful answer. I feel much better.
Let's feel worse with the next question.
Oh gosh, what is it?
So, Ian, Xi Jinping made a speech to the Chinese, well, not the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, shortly after his Taiwan speech, when he told them to, you know, be prepared for war, which happens all the time. But is this just the usual rhetoric, or is there something to be concerned about? Do you think it had
Shelley,
to do with Taiwan?
Right. I already feel worse.
Well, yes and no. Yes, because, you know, in terms of whether or not we should be concerned, yes, we should be concerned because China is building up its military power very, very rapidly. And they are preparing, you know, for a war of aggression against Taiwan and the United States and our allies. I mean, China right now, under the Chinese Communist Party, is very ambitious. They're not satisfied with their current national borders. They want to expand outwards. They want to take territory that doesn't belong to them. And they're building up a military for that very mission. And so, yeah, definitely we should be concerned about Xi Jinping telling the military to get ready for war, because their definition of war, these are not defensive wars. These are wars of conquest, whether it's the South China Sea or the East China Sea, and especially focused on Taiwan. So we should be concerned for that reason. But on the other hand, we should temper that concern at least a little bit.
Good, because I feel horrible now.
because I don't want Chris to feel too horrible. The thing is, the PLA is not ready for war. They are now engaged in this sweeping military reform and reorganization program. They're in the midst of a giant buildup, and that's going to turn them into a very lethal and very dangerous potential foe for the United States and for Taiwan and for other democracies in the next 5 years, 10 years if they're slow. They're going to be very, very dangerous for us. But they're not today, at least based on my limited knowledge. The PLA still has huge number of problems. Corruption and leadership issues are endemic. I mean, that they have really, really bad leadership and command in the PLA. Corruption is everywhere. People bought their positions in the military, and those that have been purged you know, in some cases based upon their overt corruption, but in many cases it's because they were not viewed as sufficiently loyal to Xi Jinping. And so you've created a situation where you have a military run by a bunch of lackeys, really, political lackeys. And so if you can see it, because if you listen to or if you read the transcripts of Xi Jinping's speeches to the military leaders, he's had a number of these at NDU, at their National Defense University, out in the desert, you know, the massive training range in Inner Mongolia, where he's done the troop reviews when he's in the South China Sea. He constantly is harping on the military about loyalty to him personally. He very rarely will focus on professionalism. He will focus on their need to be totally loyal to him personally.
Wasn't that also how it was under like Jiang Zemin, like top generals appointed by Jiang Zemin, making sure it's loyal? Isn't this just sort of a more of a systemic problem within the Communist Party? Not that Xi is necessarily something new.
You're right. You're absolutely right that this is par for the course, that we've seen this with Jiang Zemin. We've seen this with Hu Jintao. I think what makes it especially notable under Xi Jinping is that he is so fixated on it. He's so obsessed by it. And the themes in his speeches are more extreme than what you would see in the past. The threats, you know, he's making some pretty open threats to his top generals. And he's purged way, way more generals than any leader before him. I mean, even Mao Zedong, who was a total lunatic and a tyrant beyond measure, even Mao didn't purge military leaders as eagerly as brutally as Xi Jinping has. And so when you do that kind of thing to your military, Stalin did this to his military in the late 1930s. When you do that, you're destroying your ability to fight and win war, and which is one of the reasons that the Soviets got their backsides handed to them when the Nazis invaded, because their leadership was completely, it had been eviscerated by the purging that Stalin had done. And that's exactly what Xi Jinping is doing today. And so I don't think we're going to see a PLA in 2019 that is actually ready for a really intense war. You know, they're certainly ready for a crisis. They're ready for a low intensity or medium intensity conflict, but they're not ready for an all out war.
Medium intensity conflict we might get into with them?
Oh, how do you know it would be us?
So just notionally, you guys were out in Jinmen in December. If they were to invade Jinmen, for example, or Matsu, that would be a medium intensity fight. A low intensity fight would be an invasion of, for example, the Spratlys, you know, Itu Aba, in the South China Sea, that's guarded by, you know, Coast Guard guys, and they're tough guys, but there's a handful of guys down there guarding that island. So that would be low intensity.
So you think we might find ourselves with a war to resist Chinese aggression?
Well, I think we're already at war to resist Chinese aggression. It's just not a bloody war. It's a war of words. It's a war of hearts and minds. I think that's what the United States and other democracies are doing is we're trying to persuade the Chinese Communist Party not to invade any of their neighbors. And it's a hard sell because obviously they do intend at some point to take territory away from their neighbors. And we're trying to, you know, we're trying to persuade them not to do that. And one of the ways you persuade them is you make sure that your defensive military power is sufficient such that when they run their war games and they run their simulations, when they do their military studies, they always come to the conclusion that if they do attack their neighbors, the results for them are likely to be very bad. And that's, at the end of the day, that's the best way to make sure that they don't attack.
Well, thank you for giving us your time today, Ian. That was very insightful.
Especially
you for having me on the show, Chris.
Yeah, especially insightful about Wang Qishan and Xi Jinping's drinking bets. We'll have to carefully consider that angle, I think.
They're people, too.
I feel like it's right. I feel like that really happened. I just can't prove it.
Well, maybe our audience can send us what they think. If you guys want to learn more about Ian Easton and some of the work he's done, and a great book he wrote is The Chinese Invasion Threat, Taiwan's Defense and American Strategy in Asia. I will put a link somewhere so you guys can check it out. But yeah, that's a great book for sort of understanding the situation between the cross-strait relation.
So actually, and Chris, I'm very happy to announce to you and to your viewers and your listeners that there's actually going to be a new and slightly improved version of the book coming out. There's going to be version 2. It's going to be published by East Bridge Press and Camphor Press, and there's going to be a hardcover and a paperback version of the book coming out over the next, should be probably in a month or two. So definitely would love to share that with you.
I think that new title is The Chinese Invasion Threat Part 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Well, that's a great idea. Let me talk to the publisher about that.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I'm really excited to read that. It's great news. It's getting that update, and you know, you can be sure that I will definitely be writing the Chinese Invasion Threat fan fiction.
Oh no!
Just a little foreshadowing. There's going to be a lot of shipping between Xi Jinping and Tsai Ing-wen, and let's just say I'm going to double down on Xi Jinping as the first female president of China.
Oh, gosh.
All right. Well, Ian, if you don't regret joining us too much.
Why would you say that, Matt?
No reason, Chris. I also don't regret joining you for this podcast.
All right. Well, cool. We'll talk to you again in the future, Ian. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me on, guys. It's great talking to you.
Well, thanks for joining us today. This was a fun podcast. I think we can all agree on that.
I can see that 2019 is going to be a great year already.
Oh, yes. And again, just to remind you guys, leave a 5-star review, a 5-star rating on iTunes for us. Subscribe on iTunes. In your hearts, I want you to give us one of those 7-star Dubai ratings, though.
And also leave us a review.
And leave us a review. Was that too much? Was that too complicated? 5-star review, review. 5 stars. Give us 5-star rating and a review.
I feel like it's too complicated, but only for you.
You're having a problem between ratings and reviews right now, and I don't know why.
Well, I feel like if somebody gives you 5 stars, that is a review of a sort.
Oh, okay. It's because iTunes, the way it says, is like, you know, you can see the number of ratings and then you can see the reviews below, like the people who actually wrote something. Mm-hmm.
Just don't thank our listeners for watching.
Why would I ever do that? I would never do that. Anyways, thank you for listening to China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
I'm Matt Gnezda.
And we'll talk at you next time.